Welcome to Gospel Tangents Podcast. I'm Rick Bennett. Brigham Young is often seen as the person responsible for instituting the ban on black members from LDS temples and from the priesthood for male members. It turns out the story is a little bit more complicated than that. Russell Stevenson, biographer of Elijah Abel, talks about a few incidents with some other early contemporaries of Elijah Abel in which Brigham praised a black elder in Massachusetts. We'll talk more about this man named Walker Lewis, as well as a few other black people, and talk about why the ban was instituted in the first place. This is a really important conversation, and I hope you check it out. Before you do that, I just want to mention, since it's Black History Month, we're continuing our sale on our books on black history. So Paul Reeve, Darren Smith, we've also got our Margaret Young book on sale. So please check that out. Margaret Young's is just $3. The others are going to be 25 to 30% off on your Kindle or on Amazon. So please check that out. That's not going to last much longer, but we will have it through the month of February. Also, if you'd like to advertise your business here in Gospel Tangents, please let me know. Just email me at gospeltangents@gmail.com, and we'll be happy to team up with you to talk more about your business as well as ours. So now back to our conversation. I want to turn away from Elijah Abel for just a minute because I want to talk a little bit about a guy by the name of Warner McCary.
Yes.
I think you're familiar with him. I know he comes up in your book. So just a little bit of background on Warner McCary. I believe he joined the church in Nauvoo back in, do you remember what year?
Approximately 18, I know he was ordained the priesthood in 1846.
Okay, now I know Paul Reeve has questioned whether he was actually ordained, but you believe he was ordained in 1846?
I mean, I believe the documentation suggests this. I mean, we do know that Orson Hyde came under considerable criticism from William Smith's newspaper. For his willingness to ordain William McCary to the priesthood. In fact, there was even a newspaper article in William Smith's newspaper that called Brigham Brigham.
Oh, as a
suggesting that Brigham really had Hamitic ancestry, and that.
And
that's why he would have allowed a person like William McCary or Warner McCary. You know, he has any number of aliases to enter the Latter-day Saint community and to receive the priesthood.
Okay, so you believe Warner McCary got the priesthood in 1846 in Nauvoo?
I'm inclined to believe that. That's not something that I'm going to stake my stake my whole reputation on, but I think that's where the evidence leads us. And another reason I believe that is in the March of 1847 minutes, when Brigham Young is addressing William McCary, he mentions explicitly the example of Walker Lewis in Massachusetts, and he says he's one of the best elders that we have. Now, this is in the context that William McCary is talking about how unwelcome he's feeling within the Latter-day Saint community. All these different people are using the N-word to describe him. He says, there goes that old N-word and his white wife, referring to Lucy Stanton, who was the daughter of a former state president. Now, the fact that Brigham Young would invoke the example of Walker Lewis as a way of assuring and maybe trying to make William McCary feel better about being within the Latter-day Saint community, that tells you that Brigham Young saw William McCary and Walker Lewis as being more or less equivalent in some regard or another, and certainly within the within the realm of holding the priesthood. So I'm inclined to think that that he was. But if there's evidence suggesting otherwise, I'm happy to eat my words.
Well, I think Paul just says he doesn't have a smoking gun, so it's just a little bit questionable. So.
Right, and I agree. There is no priesthood certificate, but we do have testimony saying that he was.
Oh, okay. And who's that testimony from? I shouldn't put you on the spot like that.
Yeah, you're asking me some pretty hard questions.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, it's actually not coming to me right now.
So, okay, that's fine. So. Now, as I understand it, Warner, boy, he was quite a troublemaker.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what were some of the things that happened there? And well, I guess, was it Nauvoo or was it Winter Quarters?
It was in the greater Winter Quarters community. It also happened in Springville as well. So William McCary, he was a runaway slave. He was also a very talented musician. He was very charming. He was also something of a charismatic preacher. Right. He was very good at entertaining white people and kind of playing black as it were, right? I'm going to really channel my, you know, inner African American, and I'm going to do basically what you white people expect me to do, and preferably to, you know, for my own monetary profit, right? So, you know, he would go to the winter quarters community and he would play some music, and everyone was just amazed by all the skill of this man, William McCary. Now, at the approximately the same time, William McCary, he is beginning to kind of infiltrate the Latter-day Saint community. This wasn't the first time either. You know, he had kind of dabbled in a straying out community before this. He really liked glomming himself to Latter-day Saint communities. And he begins to flirt with some of the white women, and he begins to have sexual relationships with some of these white women. And you can argue that he saw it as a kind of polygamy, right? Or that he was simply doing what all these white people are doing, right? I mean, you're practicing polygamy, why can't I too? And this, at least according to the time and place, it's no surprise that this would inflame the tempers of some of the white men of the community. It is not long before William McCary and Lucy Stanton are run out of town on a rail. And they're running over to Missouri. And it's a few years later that we find them in Jackson County, Missouri. But that's another story entirely. So this makes it clear that the white Latter-day Saint community as a whole, I mean, one, you know, they're already saying some pretty unkind things about William McCary in March of 1847, saying, you know, there goes that old N-word and his white wife. And then when you begin to sleep around with other white women, I mean, there's just no going back. So, you know, when I speak about the development of kind of anti-black attitude, I use this as a case in point, because you have functionally a white Mormon mob chasing out a black man. And it's within this context, at this time, that Parley P. Pratt goes on record connecting, you know, Hamitic ancestry to priesthood unworthiness, saying that because this man, William McCary, has the blood of Ham in him, he is therefore unworthy or cursed as regards to the priesthood. Now, you see some rumblings before this. John Taylor made a comment in an 1845 issue of the Times and Seasons, but it wasn't as strong as Parley P. Pratt did in spring of 1847, where he uses that opportunity to really make the priesthood ban explicit and very clear. By this point, Brigham Young had, you know, he had already said that Walker Lewis was a great elder, and he left the community. So Brigham Young is all the way across the country at this point in the Great Basin Kingdom, while Parley P. Pratt is, you know, giving voice to the priesthood ban. So that's a point I also like to make to people, is that when the priesthood ban is most forcefully articulated to date, Brigham Young was several hundred miles away.
Okay, so let's just recap here, because we've got the faithful Elijah Abel in Cincinnati, Ohio. We have the faithful Walker Lewis in Boston. His son, we haven't talked about Enoch, but he had a son as well, who I believe we would consider a faithful Latter-day Saint. Mm-hmm. Then we have Warner McCary, who is causing all sorts of ruckus. And I guess we probably should talk a little bit about Enoch Lewis, because he actually, while he may be considered faithful, created a little bit of a scandal as well.
He did.
Could you talk about that?
Sure. So Brigham Young, he returns to winter quarters in December of 1847. And while there, you know, he learns about, you know, the antics of William McCary. That obviously does not bode well. But he also learns about Enoch Lewis, who has married a white woman, because that's something that is a little bit more common in Massachusetts than it is elsewhere in the country. And they have had a child. Now, Brigham Young, he was willing to support peoples of African descent holding the priesthood. That is very clear from the March of 1847 minutes. What he is not willing to abide is peoples of African descent intermingling and having sexual relationships with white women, and especially not having children. And, I mean, this is pretty conventional wisdom for the time. I mean, there was a man by the name of Josiah Knott. He was kind of one of the leading demographers and scientists of the day. He played a major role in kind of framing the terms and the questions undergirding the 1850 census. And to him, when an African or an African-American or someone who has African descent intermarries with a Caucasian, you know, your child is going to be a quote-unquote mulatto, Now, the term mulatto, it derives from the term mule, and mules were believed to be sterile, and that's why they were called mulattoes. It's like, okay, you are now sterile, you're not able to have children. And for Brigham Young, having children was the purpose of life, right? He says that later in a letter to Thomas Kane, right? That, you know, we are here to build up, right? We're here to have children and have massive kingdoms with all these people, right? To populate worlds. So the idea of somebody knowingly and willingly, you know, causing that kind of relationship to come into being, and knowingly and willingly producing a quote-unquote mulatto child who is now incapable of doing the very thing that humanity was meant to do, that was unforgivable. That was outrageous. It was disgusting. So when Brigham Young finds out about this relationship, I mean, his initial response is a violent one, right? That they deserve the death penalty. They deserve to be killed, you know, for daring to cross this kind of social and, in his mind, moral bound. But it's interesting because at the same time that he's making these comments about interracial unions, he's also showing another side of himself. He's saying, but on the other hand, you know, if they both requested baptism, can you really deny them? He clearly is having some compunctions about, you know, withholding certain blessings from peoples of African descent. And then on the other hand, though, he said, really, the only way that they can enjoy these blessings is if they agree to be eunuchs, right? Is, you know, if they do not have kids, because that, again, that's the greatest crime of all. So in this moment, you know, Brigham Young reveals kind of the competing impulses within him. Is, you know, do I go down this road and do I, you know, adopt the conventional thinking of the day, or do I adopt, you know, the kind of the universality that the temple provides, or do I find some kind of middle road? It's clear that Brigham Young is sort of, he's quite conflicted on this point. Now, according, as we see in February of 1849, he ends up lurching in the direction towards racial segregation within the church, saying that, you know, peoples of African descent could not hold the priesthood. Now, the way this ends up getting interpreted later on is that they could not receive temple blessings either.
Well, so, yeah, so that's great. I guess I have a question for you with regards to that. So we've got this very scandalous interracial relationship in Massachusetts. We have Warner McCary and his very scandalous polygamy going on. Do you think we want to tie this all back to Elijah Abel eventually. I guess I wonder if this temple ban was a reaction to these, especially these two relationships here in particular. And there might have been a third one with Joseph Ball.
Joseph Ball, right. It's been debated how much African ancestry he has, but there's certainly an argument to be made for him as well.
So, and I don't know, maybe we should talk a little bit about Joseph Ball. Do you feel comfortable talking about that?
I do know that he had some difficulties. He was living in Massachusetts like Walker Lewis was at the time, and he was certainly not trusted as a priesthood leader. He was believed to be having some affairs with some of the female members of the ward. I believe it was Wilfred Woodruff who, you know, recorded this and saying that, you know, he was just doing some very inappropriate things. As far as his ethnic ancestry, I do know that Connell Donovan has said that Joseph Ball passed as being white.
Oh, so he was very light-skinned.
He was very light-skinned, but O'Donovan argues that ultimately he did descend from African descent. Okay. He did descend from African ancestry.
Now, the interesting thing was he was also ordained a high priest by William Smith, who also denounced Brigham.
Yeah. William Smith is a man of contradictions, and he's always, I remember speaking with one historian who was affiliated with the Community of Christ, where he said, listen, I'm all about, you know, resuscitating and reviving and resurrecting, you know, once despised historical figures, but William Smith, that's really hard for me to do.
So we have William Smith ordaining a black man to be a high priest and branch president in Massachusetts. So my question is, going back to that whole thing, so we've got three very scandalous relationships going on, interracial relationships. Do you think that part of the reason why Brigham stopped any temple work was to prevent any sort of temple marriage?
When you say stopped any temple work,
Temple marriage, sealing.
Oh.
Sealing. Because I guess I have a theory that, you know, Brigham wanted to put a stop to interracial marriage.
Yes.
Period. And the best way to stop that is to say, we're not going to solemnize this in the temple. Do you think that's a reasonable conclusion from these three experiences?
I mean, I think for him, the idea of any black man marrying any white woman was odious. So it would only follow that, okay, well, that's even odious according to secular natural law, let alone for the higher celestial law. I mean, it was even more odious. Now, to be sure, when he was interacting with William McCary and Lucy Stanton, he did not say any of these things to their face, but that does not mean that he did not believe them, because clearly, you know, it's only a matter of about 9 months later that he gave voice to these things. So I'm not going to say that over the course of 9 months, you know, these ideas just sort of popped up on their own, right? They probably existed at that time. He just didn't say them to their face. So yeah, I think that's a reasonable conclusion that, you know, Brigham Young, he sees this as a really awful kind of anti-humanity sort of practice, the kind of thing that kills off entire civilizations if it's carried out to its natural extension. So he said, I'm not going to legitimize this or solemnize this, you know, through temple ordinances.
Okay, yeah. So, lost my train of thought there. So let's go back. So we've got these three big scandals. Now, one of the interesting things about, let's talk about Joseph Ball for 1 second. I believe he was ordained as branch president in Massachusetts. He served for about 6 months, and then he and William were sent, I believe by Parley P. Pratt, to Nauvoo to, quote, work on the temple. Mm. Now, there's a question, you know, there's no temple restriction at this time.
Right.
We know, as we talked about earlier, that Elijah Abel participated in the Kirtland Endowment, which we would now refer to as the initiatory.
Right.
So what happened with William Smith and Joseph Ball in Nauvoo? Are you familiar with that story?
I mean, we do know that the Nauvoo Temple was publicly billed as being for all nations, kindreds, tongues, and peoples. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see that kind of thing happen. I mean, Joseph Smith made it quite clear, like through his support of the ordination of Elijah, that, you know, the Nauvoo Temple was to be open to all people. And I mean, it's 1846 before the saints leave, and we know that as of spring of 1847, Brigham Young was still supporting, you know, people like William McCary, people like Walker Lewis holding the priesthood. So yes, that's that kind of thing would make sense.
So I'm just wondering, because it seems like William Smith came to Nauvoo, and I think he was made church patriarch, and then was excommunicated promptly after that.
Right. And yet he kept giving patriarchal blessings, right? Because he just loved it.
I want to say, if my memory is correct, that he gave a patriarchal blessing to this Joseph Ball and declared him of the tribe of Cain, if my memory is
okay,
correct.
Okay, I've not read that.
Oh, you've not read that?
I've not read the patriarchal
blessing. I believe that's Connell O'Donovan mentioned that. So, so I guess we don't really know what happened with Joseph Ball at that point, but we know that William left, and I think that's when you mentioned he published about blacks and the priesthood. So I still don't get those contradictions with William ordaining a black man and then complaining about it.
What it does is, I mean, it speaks to the nature of discourse at the time, right? I mean, I've had, this is anecdotal evidence that I'm sharing at this point, but you know, I've had African-American friends where they have white friends and they think, okay, we're cool, everything's fine, and then all of a sudden, the second there's a fight, the second there's a conflict, they pull out the N-word, right? And it's like, oh, so you've been holding that in the chambers this whole time, right? And that says something about racial discourse in the 1840s, is that's something that you hold in the chambers, right? That's something that's always on a subterranean level. And, you know, things can be all fine and they're all great until they're not. And then that can become your go-to, and that cuts a person in the 1840s. I mean, these days it's obviously incredibly offensive, and you know it will cause you all kinds of problems. But at the time, you know, that was typical polemics within you know, among newspapers.
And while you've got your speculative hat on,
you know, put on the antennas.
There
right?
you go. So I just wonder, you know, we're just before the Warner McCary incident and Joseph Ball. He's had some interracial marriage, but I don't know how well known that is. So Elijah Abel has already left Nauvoo by now, so he's not going to get the endowment because he's not there.
Yeah.
So my question is, around this time, 1846, when the temple, I believe, was completed then, mm-hmm. or really close to then, we have three, I guess, good candidates to participate in temple ordinances.
Yes.
Joseph Ball, Elijah Abel, maybe Warden McCary, and Walker Lewis, so
yeah.
four.
Yeah.
Do you think that, you know, if the planets had aligned, that maybe they might have participated in those ordinances?
You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, one way of approaching that is, you know, let's just say that we could magically take the temple and move it to Cincinnati, right? Every piece of evidence that we would have in Cincinnati at that time, you know, would suggest that Elijah was in full fellowship with the church, that he enjoyed some gravitas within the community, that he was able to call for the excommunication of dissidents, and he would be listened to. I think in those circumstances, and again, we're kind of inventing these circumstances, it's like the counterfactuals, it's a great parlor game, but it can be treacherous territory. But I think in that circumstance, it would be fair to suppose that Elijah would have received an endowment.
Yeah, I mean, I think so too.
It's certainly not unreasonable.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing that seems like Elijah had done anything to prevent him from doing so. So as we look, I mean, so I think 1846, 1847 are really critical, mm-hmm. probably one of the most pivotal years with how the ban was formulated, with all the yeah. things that happened, especially yeah. in regards to interracial marriage.
Absolutely.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Russell Stevenson. In our next conversation, we'll talk about the end of Elijah Abel's life. Did he continue to try to petition for temple blessings?
Now in 1879, you know, he does petition to receive his temple endowment. Right? By this point, his wife has passed away, and you know, we do have some evidence that he petitioned Brigham Young at some point.
Thank you so much for listening. Make sure that you like our page on facebook.com/gospeltangents. You can subscribe at YouTube at youtube.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter @gospeltangents, as well as make sure that you subscribe on iTunes so you don't miss any of our episodes. Thanks again for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our videos. Thanks again.